they could get closer to land, close enough to land to disembark on the land in the smaller boat. And they would usually pull it behind them. And last week we talked about how that in order that they would not lose this boat, they pulled the boat to them and lifted it up enough and tied it off to the ship so that they would keep it together. Now here's some of these sailors have come upon a brilliant idea. They said, well, we're close to land. All of us may not be able to make it, but here's the boat. Let's act like that we're putting anchors overboard, and let's the few of us get into this boat and make it on our own. So that's what they have in mind and they're about to do. Verse 31, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. So Paul sees what's going on. He tells the soldier, he says, listen, if you don't stop those guys from doing that, you will not be saved. So the soldiers go over, and they don't just get the guys, the sailors, away from the boat. Into the boat. There's no hope to use that boat again. In verse 33, and while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, this day is the 14th day that you have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. Wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you. Now I don't know if they are fasting in order that they may gain God's favor, or if they're fasting in order to, in the midst of their prayers, to pray and fast in order to seek God's face for safety, or if they are so busy and so distraught in trying to save this ship that they just haven't had time to eat. But it's been a while since they have eaten. And Paul comes to them and says, it's been a while since you've eaten. You need to eat so that you might gain your strength. No one will be hurt. Let's eat. Verse 35, and when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. Now that's an interesting verse or two there. Paul takes his food. He looks to the heavens perhaps and gives thanks to God for his provision. And eat. And the result of what Paul does there encourages the rest of them. Because they were of good cheer and their spirits were lifted and they too ate. Then notice what it says in verse 37. And we were in all in the ship, 200 threescore and 16 souls. Or in other words, 276 people were on this boat. So this wasn't just your average party barge, was it? Pretty good sized ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. Now this reads to me like that when they got through eating, you remember last week we saw that they've been throwing overboard everything that they can do without just to try to lighten the ship. This is a cargo ship that Paul and the centurion just catch a ride on, you know, to Rome or to Italy. They throw over the cargo. The only reason this ship is sailing is to carry this cargo from one port to another. It's a business ship. And they throw the cargo over. Forget our mission. Let's save our life. They've thrown over some of the tackle, the things that they need to sail this ship. And now they come to the place where they eat, these 276 people eat a meal, and it seems like that when they get through eating, they throw the rest of their food out. Now that's burning your bridges behind you, isn't it? This is the last meal we're going to eat in this ship. Lighten the load, throw the rest of the food out, if that's the wheat is their eatable food. Verse 39. And when it was day, they knew not the land. So they do see the land. But they discovered a certain creek with a shore, into which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. When they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea, and loosed the rubber bands, and hoisted up their main sail to the wind, and made toward shore. And falling into a place where the two seas met, they ran the ship aground. And the forepart stuck fast, and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. So it becomes daylight. They head toward, they see the land, they see a little inlet there that they think might be our best shot to run this ship toward. They know they're going to run the ship aground somewhere. And they run the ship aground. It hangs up as it runs aground there, but the back end of it, the storm is still raging, and the back end eventually tears the ship apart. As that's happening, the soldiers request permission from the centurion to kill all the prisoners. And this is, as you know a little bit of Bible history, as you've studied the New Testament, this is an important thing, that a soldier would not let his prisoners escape, but rather kill them than let them escape or something happen to them. So they are at the point where they are no longer going to be able to keep a watch on these prisoners, because the ship is breaking apart and it's going to be basically every man for himself. So they ask the centurion, "Do you want us, while we've still got an opportunity, to kill the prisoners?" And the centurion, in verse 43, notice this phrase, "willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, and commanded that they should swim, that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards, and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land." Just like God said, right? Now, I want us to look at several things. I'm calling this walking through the night. And that preposition there, through, was chosen intentionally with some thought. It's not walking in the night. It's not walking by the night, but it's walking through the night. As we find ourselves in darkness, and at times we find ourselves in such, our lives in such turmoil, that there comes a point where we lose all hope. And I don't know if you have ever been there or not. And maybe some of the potential situations that I want to describe for you may fit you. I'm not trying to describe you. Some of them may fit me or have fit me. But we can find our lives can be in such turmoil and in such havoc, can wreck our lives, that we come to the place where we lose hope. You remember John last week talked about just the semi-wreck that he had driving the truck, and where for that brief period of time, it may not have been but 15 seconds. I don't know how long that it was that he talked about being out of control of the semi. You remember that? I don't know if you have ever experienced situations where suddenly you were totally out of control. There was nothing you could do to change the circumstances of your life. It may not have been but for 5 seconds. But sometimes it may seem, and it may literally be, 5 years. 5 months. You know, when I was a kid, I was, for a brief period of time, was a Boy Scout when I was 12 or 13 years old. And we had moved up here from Southeast Arkansas, and at Southeast Arkansas, there are no suitable places to swim. Lake Sheco, if anybody's familiar with Lake Sheco, I used to could swim in Lake Sheco when I was a kid, and Lake Sheco was about the color of these altar benches up here. And I never knew there were any different. That's the only lake I'd ever seen in my life, and I thought that's the way lakes were until I came up here, and golly, you can see, you know, 4 or 5 feet in the water here, and that was an amazing thing. But anyway, I grew up not knowing how to swim until I was 10 or 12, 13 years old. And my parents weren't lake people anyway, and there was no place to learn, so I just never been. Well, I joined the Boy Scouts, and we went camping at Big Creek over toward Wilburn. And there was the creek there. And I had wandered out in this creek on this flat ledge about waist high or chest high, and without knowing that there was an abrupt drop in my next step, I stepped off of it and went under. And I'll tell you what went through my mind. You go under 3 times and then you drown. You ever heard that saying before? Well, that's not true. Not necessarily true. Okay? Here's what I remember. 1 time, help! 2 times, help! 3 times, it's over. I don't know how many times I kept coming up and going down, but as far as I was concerned, I had heard 3 times and you drown. I thought, when I went down that third time, I was conscious of the first time, second time, third time, and I thought, this is it. All hope that I had to not drown was gone. Now, I didn't just go limp and drown. You will fight to live. You will fight to survive. And I kept going up and down, I don't know how many times, and there was this big kid on the bank that was a big kid, and some other guys come out there to try to rescue me that was about my size, and I was on top of him like a coon on a hound dog, you know. He was under and I was up, you know. And this big kid on the bank said, "Hit him if you have to," and all I could envision in my mind was this big kid, which was a big kid, hauling off and hitting me. And I straightened my legs up, and I was back over the shelf there. I was standing right here. You know, but here's the point I want to make. I don't know what went through my mind after that third time. But I did not expect. It was like my mind was blank. My body was fighting, but as far as my mind and my spirit, as far as I knew, it was over. That may have lasted, I don't know how long it lasted, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, I don't know. You know, all night, all areas of darkness are not quite that short. You remember in the Old Testament when David had sinned because he had numbered the people? And God gave David a choice of 2 or 3 things, and I should have looked this up, 2 or 3 punishments that he would give him a choice, and David could choose the punishment that was God would mete out. And this punishment didn't just affect David. Does anybody remember what the 3 were? I should have looked this up. I said that, didn't I? Okay. One was 3 days pestilence, if I remember correctly. And the other 2 affected more people and for a longer period of time. If I remember correctly, David chose the shortest one. Now, I don't know why he did that. But I know that it's not within our nature to enjoy hard times. We don't like that, and understandably so. You know, I've seen people, and we're talking about losing hope. I've seen people walking down the street of Little Rock. I've seen people walking down the street of Heber Springs. And I can't help but think that this person has lost all hope that they have for much of anything in life. And I may be prejudging them, and I may be reading more into their life than is actually there. But I'll tell you, I want to describe to you someone's life, and you probably can imagine this happening over and over again in the world. Some young man, some teenage boy, is raised. Actually, he's not raised. He just lives in a house with some other people. And he grows up living an undisciplined life. He spends every dime he may get on things that's consumable. They're gone. Drugs, alcohol, whatever it may be. Expensive wheels for his car, toys, games, gimmicks, gadgets. But he's habitually broke. And he is habitually spending his money on things that bring pleasure for a little while, but they are sinful things. And eventually, it catches up to him. Eventually, he is in trouble with the law. Eventually, he loses his driver's license. Eventually, he is on parole. Eventually, he's all of these things. He hasn't a job. He can't keep a job. He's not skilled at anything. He cannot do anything to better his situation. Now, I've seen these people walking down the street to a job because they can't have a license. And every paycheck that they get is spent either on alcohol or drugs. They eventually can't even buy or support a place to live. And the further they go, the deeper they get. And eventually the rest of their life is lived just covering up the hopelessness with alcohol or drugs. Their body still functions. They still breathe. They still talk. They go from one short job to another short job, or short stay at a job. But all reason to live is gone. Some people can be in a marriage, and their marriage can be so bad. Things can be so out of whack. Things can be so terrible and uncomfortable and painful that it comes a point where they just exist. If they remain married and stay living together, they just go through the motions. There is nothing fruitful or hopeful about it. Someone can be in a financial situation and things be so bad and the bills keep piling up and piling up and piling up. And you juggle this and you juggle that and things just go from bad to worse. And it can come to a point where all hope is lost that things will ever get better. We're going to look at this text this morning. That's where these soldiers are at. That's where these sailors are at. These 276 people who are in this ship, perhaps with the exception of a few, have lost hope. You see that phrase there at the top of your page? And all hope was gone. All hope that we should be saved was taken from us. Who took this hope from them? The storm. The storm that they faced and that buffeted them took away their hope that they would survive. But I want to look at three or four things in this text that when you find yourself in the storms of night and you're walking through the night, remember these five things. The first one is this: hope for the day. Look in verse 29. They have sounded and found out that the ocean floor was only 120 foot down. A few minutes later, they did it again, or hours later, whatever. They found it was 90 feet down. They knew they were approaching land. They cast out four anchors to keep themselves from being dashed on the rocks. Notice what it says in verse 29. Then, fearing lest we should have fallen on the rocks, we cast out four anchors into the stern and wished for the day. Hoped for the day. It is nighttime. They can't see what's going on. They know that or feel like they're getting close to land, and they're afraid they're going to be dashed up on the rocks. They cast out the anchors and hope for the day. The first thing when you are in the storms of life is hope for the day. You know, sometimes we have this mistaken idea that it is ungodly to want to be delivered from trials. That when God allows us to walk through hard times, and God allows us to walk through and go through storms, if we want to be delivered from that, we feel like that we are not doing right, that we're not spiritual enough, or we would have be filled with joy in the midst of this trial and just want to stay there. Now, I'm not talking about being in despair. In the midst of trials, if we are filled with despair, that's not right. But even when we count it all joy, we can ask God, God, please deliver me from this storm. King David. Do you remember the life of King David? David, as a lad or as a teenage boy, I suppose, was anointed by Samuel to be the next king. Sometime after that, he was on his way to carry his brothers a message or some food or whatever from home at the front lines of the battle or the battleground. They weren't actually fighting. He sees it gets to the army where they're encamped across from the Philistines. And it's a standoff. You remember the story. He says, what is going on? They say, well, the other team has got this giant named Goliath, and he's challenged us. Instead of us all fighting, let's just you pick a man, we'll pick a man. Now, that's fine if you've got Goliath, isn't it? But Israel didn't have Goliath or anyone like him. They were trying to figure out what to do, and here comes this lad. He says, what are you? Are you afraid of this uncircumcised Philistine? You remember the story, he goes out and kills him. Saul, the king, is jealous. David, and I don't know if Saul knows this or not, but David has already been anointed to be king. And for the next several years, David walks through a dark time. Because at every opportunity, Saul, the king, is trying to kill him, to take his life, to slander him. Does David count it all joy to have to walk in fear of his life for several years? I don't know, but I know you can read the Psalms and over again. David says, deliver me, O God. Friends,
from my enemies. Deliver me. Hoping for the day. When Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, you remember what He said? Oh God, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. It is not wrong to want to be delivered from the darkness that overwhelms us. That's where these soldiers are at. They are cast out the anchors. It is dark. They cannot see the rocks. And they do all they can do, and they hope for the day. Wait until it's daylight. Second thing is cling to the truth. Cling to the truth. I want you to notice several phrases that are found in this text that I'm using them as truth. They are statements that God has told to Paul that this is what will happen. And Paul is relaying them on to the sailors and to the others. The first one is this, that no life will be lost, only the ship. So that's truth number one in this particular story. No one will be killed, the ship will be destroyed, but no life will be lost. Number two, Paul must appear before Caesar. When God tells Paul this, God reminds Paul, Paul, you've got to appear before Caesar. So there's another statement of truth. Paul must appear before Caesar. The third thing, we must run aground on some island. This is another thing, the last thing, at least in that those few verses, that God told Paul, you will run aground on an island, the ship will be destroyed, but no one will be killed. And the last one is where, not the last one, but where he tells the centurion or the soldiers, if you let those guys get in that boat and escape, you will not be saved. Now I take that as Paul telling them that as a word from God. This is what's going to happen. In order for all of us to be safe, these guys are going to have to stay on the boat. That's truth. Cling to the truth. Paul knew what promise God had made. Paul knew the promise that God, the word that God had told him, this is what's going to happen. And he lived his life. And he ordered his affairs. And he looked at those around him in light of that truth. And we need to do that. In the middle of the terrible circumstances that we may find ourselves in, we need to know some truth. And we need to hold on to it and not let it go. You have heard me say before, and I want to say it again. In the middle of a storm is a bad time to learn your theology. Now, it doesn't mean you need to not try to learn some then. But a better time to learn it is when you can think a little more objectively. And that's when the storm is not going on. But you know what we do? When things are going smooth, and our ship is smooth sailing, and everything's going nice and easy, and life is good, that's the time that we relax from our study of truth. We take it a little more easy. Studying God's Word is not quite so serious to us at that time. And yet that's the time that we ought to be grounding ourselves in truth. So that when the storms attack us, our foundation will be deep and solid. When the storms affect us morally, we ought to know some moral truths that are unnegotiable. When your marriage is on the rocks, you ought to have already figured out God's standard for marriage. That's a tough time. That's a bad time to be deciding what's right or wrong in this issue of divorce. You ought to have that figured out before you get married. It ought to be settled in your mind. Cling to the truth. Then number three, cut loose all quick fixes. When Paul looked over and saw the sailors fixing to save themselves, get in the boat and just escape as best they could, he said, if these guys get out of this boat, we won't be saved. The soldiers went over and they didn't just say, you guys get away from that boat. You're not getting in the boat. They cut loose the boat and the boat fell away. Those sailors were no longer tempted to escape in the boat. You know why? Boat gone. Boat wasn't there. Right? They fixed that. You know, sometimes when I have found myself in tough situations and life is uncomfortable and I don't like uncomfortable living, I look for an easy way, a quick way out. And sometimes that's not right. I want to give you a couple of situations that are common. A single mother. She may be divorced, and she finds herself raising her children alone. I'll tell you, I haven't experienced that, but I know that's hard. Susan has gone to Conway to help Missy one day a week for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I would hate to come home from work. I mean, I've hated one day a week and have to figure out for myself what's for supper. Have to hope that there's enough clothes washed for me tomorrow. Let me tell you what she does. She goes on, has been going on Wednesday, Tuesday. She'll cook something that I like, that's big enough that I can eat it until she gets back. That's tough living, isn't it? I haven't had to worry about washing my clothes. I may rinse off my dirty dishes and put them in the sink. I did figure out 1 week how to put them in the dishwasher. That's rough, ain't it? But let me tell you, I don't like it. That's a little too hard for me. But to come home as a single mom with 2 or 3 kids and have worked all day for almost nothing, and then have to cook, then have to deal with the kids and the schooling or whatever it may be, have to wash the clothes, have to put up with the fussing and the fighting among the kids, do all of this, go to bed, get up the next day and do it again and do it over and over and over again. It's no wonder that more often than not, a single mom's second marriage is much worse than the first. Looking for a quick fix, somebody to help me. The end is worse than the beginning. Financial problems. This may not fit everybody. So if it don't fit you, don't be offended. Credit cards are a terrible way to fix financial problems. I want to tell you, the person who can use a credit card and that credit card be their slave. The credit card is their slave. That person is, those people are few and far between. More often than not, the people end up serving the credit card. I've heard a statement from someone who is experiencing financial difficulty primarily because of credit cards. You know the routine, to cut up all the cards, get rid of all the cards, except one. I'm going to use that because at the end of every month, if we're a little bit short, we use a credit card. Well, what happens at the end of the month if you had a financial problem to start with? You're a little short. So something goes on the credit card. You see something wrong with that picture? The next month, you're even a little more short. And the routine is something like this. We got this credit card that's not maxed out. We quick fix by putting things on that credit card while we try to get these paid down. We get them paid down a little bit where there's a little bit on them. That time this one's maxed out, so we use this one a little bit while this one's maxed out, get it paid down. And then you can't do that with two. Then you've got to take a third and then a fourth. That is not a way to fix financial situation. That is a quick fix. That is not a fix at all. Bankruptcy. Anybody ever see the bankruptcy listings in the state paper on Monday mornings? It's a long list. Arkansas bankruptcies. Once a week, they're in the Monday paper. Probably 300, 400 every week. Bankruptcy, is that a quick fix? That might keep the creditors off your tail. But it might not ethically relieve you from debt. It might legally, but maybe not ethically. A quick fix. It's not quite a quick fix. But we like those things. You know, I don't know what your weaknesses are. I know a couple of mine. Some of them I haven't acknowledged yet. But I've learned, if this is a weakness for me, don't make provision for it. Romans, I think it's the 13th chapter, says, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for your flesh. I don't know what your weaknesses are. I may know some of your weaknesses, but I know a couple of mine. And if I am wise, I will not make provision for them. Let me tell you a little statement. It is easier to avoid temptations than to resist it. Write that down and memorize it. And it will make your life easier if you will live by it. It is easier to avoid temptation than to resist it. Cut loose all the quick fixes. Let them fall away. Number four, keep things in an eternal perspective. You know, Paul came to these people and he said, listen, you haven't eaten, you need to eat. And we're about to get off this ship. And Paul takes food. And I like this. I don't know. You know, when I picture this in my mind, it's kind of like they're all just, you know, standing around. Paul's fixing to eat. But somehow I keep forgetting the storm. I don't know where they're at. I don't know if they're below. Surely they probably are, the main deck, the top deck. I don't know where they're at. But somehow, this ship is rocking, and they are in fear of their life. And in the midst of that, Paul takes food and lifts his eyes toward heaven, I suppose, says, oh God, thank you. Thank you for your provision. And somehow, as he does that and eats, God uses that to encourage those around him. He says, and they were of good cheer, and they took and ate. Keeping things in an eternal perspective, the storm that we are facing is not the end. It is only a small portion in eternity, of time in eternity. Then, number five, being a conduit of God's grace. These first four things are active. Paul is active in these things. Paul is, or these people in this boat, they are hoping. They're doing it. They're hoping for the day. Paul is clinging to the truth. He's actively doing this thing. They have actively cut loose the boat. They are keeping things in eternal perspective. But this last thing, they are passive in. This is what God is doing. God is using Paul's life in the midst of this storm to be a conduit of His grace. I want you to look at several things. Look at verse 22 at what Paul says. Paul's telling them about what God has told him. In verse 22, he says, I exhort you, be of good cheer. Paul tells them, cheer up. Be of good cheer. Then go down to verse 25. Sirs, be of good cheer. He says that again. For I believe God, and it will be just as He said. And then you get to verse 36, and it says, they were of good cheer. He has exhorted them, do this, do this, do this. And then they were. They did it. And then the last thing. The centurion, willing to keep Paul alive. When it came down to the time where they asked permission to kill the prisoners, the centurion, willing to keep Paul alive, did more than that, didn't he? He didn't just keep Paul alive, he kept them all alive. You know, sometimes the grace that God puts in your life spills out and does somebody else some good. You know, I don't know where you are at. My life right now is not stormful. Is that a word? I'm not in a storm. My life is not terribly hectic or uncomfortable or chaotic. It's just not. It might be next week. It might be next year. It may be before the day's over. I don't know. Yours may be now. I don't know. You may be find yourself tossed and whipped, and things are not what they ought to be, and you know that, and you just are at your wit's end to get them right. Hope you would consider these four things. Hope for the day. Cling to what you know to be true. Avoid quick fixes. Keep things in eternal perspective. I believe if we do that, that God will use our lives in the midst of the storm to be a conduit of His grace, not just to us, but more importantly, to those around us. The people that have ministered the most to me are the people who have been hurt the deepest. They have come through the storm, and they have touched my life. God's grace, as I drew close to them, spilled out. And as I touched their life, I got grace on my hands. And I was blessed. Let's pray. Oh God, oh God, God, may we say, in the midst of these times, the Lord gives. The Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Amen.